Therapy Insiders is brought to you by Verve, makers of the Arc, a revolutionary neck pain relief and postural support device, available now at www.goarcnow.com, and by Edge Mobility System. Give your mobility the edge. Available at www.edgemobilitysystem.com.
Hello, welcome back to Therapy Insiders. I am Dr. Gene Schrockerbrod here with Dr. Erson Religioso. Dr. Joe won't be joining us today because he's having internet issues, but we do have a special guest that you probably know if you've been on Twitter or read good blogs. He is Dr. Ben Fung from, what's the website, Ben, so I don't say wrong?
DrBenFung.org.
Well, that was hard.
How are we supposed to remember that?
Yes, damn it, Ben.
Too difficult.
Come on. So we've covered a variety of topics over, last 6 months, Urs?
Yeah, definitely.
Spanning from business with Jerry Durham, shout out, to more business with Ann Wendell, shout out, to even more business with Heidi Janenga and Larry Benz. So why the heck not talk a little bit more branding and business and maybe some insurance. Who knows? We'll see how we're feeling.
Or food. We're all foodies.
That's true.
Food's a good topic.
We just talked a little bit about steak before we started recording because I was chowing down before we went live and Urson was worried that I would choke. So I didn't, and here we are. But anyway, Ben, you posted a blog today or a blog post covering, I think, some important information. And that information pertains to healthcare in general and our role in fixing it, right? It's
yes.
Because it's in a state of downturn. You can say we're recycling old adages, and I loved what you said in the quote in your post. You quoted Henry Ford, I believe, that we don't want to, or to paraphrase, we don't really want to make a better horse and buggy. We want a horseless carriage, and that's innovation. And at this point, that's disruption. So, let me throw out the loaded question to you: how the hell do we disrupt healthcare?
Well, to disrupt healthcare, I think we need to take it apart piece by piece and see it for what it is. I was talking to my father actually this afternoon, which Urson and I have in common. He's a physician, and we're just talking about the sustainability of healthcare as it is.
I thought you were going to say you and Urson have the same father. I was just like, what?
Darth Vader. Yeah.
Speaking of Darth Vader, if you haven't watched the new Star Wars trailer, it was incredible.
I was at Celebration.
That is incredible in itself.
Yeah, they made $2 billion just from the trailer. Basically, if they released one more trailer, they bought off George Lucas or
absolutely. I was kind of skeptical about the new movie. And then when I saw that trailer, I had goosebumps and I felt like a child again.
Yeah.
But anyway, disruption of healthcare.
So let's turn down to just a Star Wars podcast from there on out.
It'll go downhill so fast. All right, healthcare disruption.
Healthcare, something he's been big on, and I fully agree, is that when the healthcare professions started to diverge, it used to be just the practice of medicine, and then everything seemed to just funnel under that one umbrella. You know, nursing was an aspect of medicine, therapy was an aspect of medicine, pharmacy was an aspect of medicine. And then when it became systematized and monetized and a calling, you know, to further elevate, you know, human value, turned into an earning scheme, that's where healthcare really got born. It became a business model and a service model, and it quickly became unsustainable. And that's a lot of what I wrote down in my thoughts in this two-part post, is attacking that success dilemma in healthcare and how do we disrupt it, you know. And by definition, whenever anything hits that barrier, that brick wall of the success dilemma, that no matter how many times we try the same thing over and over, despite how much it has attributed and contributed to our past success, it no longer is viable. Disruption requires that we start to recombine certain attributes of the service or the products, so that we can create new ways of thinking, new lifestyles, and most importantly, a new set of human behaviors. That's really where disruptive innovation occurs.
Well, obviously, disruption is hard, right? Because you are going against status quo and you're breaking apart a way of thinking, a way of working, and a way of making money for people that are making money, right? It doesn't matter how badly something is working, there's going to be people that are making a ton of money and are successful. And another thing that I liked about your post in the beginning, you said, you know, let's not kid ourselves. It comes down to money. It always comes down to money. Should it? Of course not. It should come down to customer care and satisfaction and outcomes and all that good stuff, which most good clinicians focus on and continue to focus on. But disruption isn't about that. Disruption is about combining focus on customers and outcomes and achieving a good result for your patients, your customers, your clients, whatever you want to call them, while integrating the business side of it. You can't have one without the other. They have to merge together in a new way that is growth for the future. It doesn't have to be polished initially, but it has to be something that can be scaled and evolved and grown, right? So how do we combine the two? Because we're never taught in school how to be businessmen, how to think like entrepreneurs, which is something that we in this podcast have been very stringent or adamant about, is integrating our, you know, the DPT student or whatever profession you're listening from, med students or whatever it is, even though med students and dentists and even chiropractors get some of this in their programs. So what do we do? What do we do to get better? And a question for you from Twitter, Chris Hinsey. Chris, if you're listening to this, please tell me how to say your name. But it's at C Hinsey DPT. He asked, Ben, if your son grows up to be a physio, what do you hope the profession looks like for him and others in 20 plus years? Because disruption technically would probably take that long to make an effort to make a dent and really have widespread changes. So what do you want to see in 20 years?
Well, in 20 years, I'd like to see a paradigm that's so different than what we have right now. You know, like we've been talking about, you know, some whisperings about opening an insurance company and you know, disrupting healthcare, even a change of the paradigm. What I suggest is, you know, value-based, agile network model healthcare. What I like to see in 20 years is that health is a social and cultural value, and that it is born within the fabric of society, and that our professions aren't serving in a hierarchical form. It's not a waterfall. You know, one person has to do one step, the next person has to do the next step, and it's a checklist that's very linear. I'd like to see something multidimensional. I like to see a model where it's not necessarily the physician who's the chief. They're not the absolute authority. And it's not that, you know, the medical doctor isn't valuable by any means. It's just that sometimes the physician isn't the best suited provider for a patient's care in one instance or specific case. And throughout the lifespan of, you know, any given patient or even patient populations, it still may not be a family physician that would serve best as a, you know, team lead or a case lead. So I'd like to see that occur, where instead of a linear hierarchical health system and culture, I'd like to see something more networked, more multidimensional. Think of it kind of like a Rubik's Cube.
So does that involve Unity? So Scott McAfee at McAfee PT was also on our previous podcast about the future perspective. He was one of the three DPT students that participated. He asked, do current interprofessional care models have a chance at establishing the unity among professions? Which is kind of sounds like what you're talking about, is having a flow between professions that we have a, I guess, an almost an algorithm of which customers and patients would get seen better by which profession instead of the kind of referral system and bouncing them around.
Absolutely. Unity is really the only way. You know, I wrote in my post, we can either win this together or we can lose it, you know, piece by piece until no one's left. And it just requires every one of us, instead of arguing over the piece of the pie, to realize, look, healthcare as it stands is not a sustainable system. You know, the costs involved are so ghastly that it will eventually crumble on its own unless all the providers and all the professionals and everyone involved in this, you know, living beast come together to tame it.
Yeah, that's the hard. Only way. I mean, you know, I always talk about our own professional infighting and how that's holding us back, and how I also a good many of us aren't even, they don't even look outside the profession. They have trouble referring out to, say, we would never refer out to a massage therapist or an acupuncturist or a personal trainer because most PTs think they can kind of do it all. But if we can't even get over ourselves, how could we even network? Because most of us don't even refer out. I mean, that's rough, I think. And I think other professions are like that too. Everyone just wants to kind of keep the business to themselves.
Absolutely. But I think we touched on it early in this podcast. You know, it's all about the money eventually, right? The system is broken because there is no more money left to have. I think that's where you're going to see some of the leadership initiatives and some of the larger organizations that just, they can't absorb the kind of risk by just keeping down this path and hoping nothing breaks. I think you're going to start to see, and I've heard plenty of talks of this, you know, behind closed doors, without naming names, there are doctors, physicians, PTs, and administrators, policymakers that are looking outside of the normal paradigm, and they're following the money, and they're realizing that there are effective ways where you could have a collaborative group model. And it may just take that. It may take a certain level of policymaking to encourage some form of unity, you know, either at cost of that or at cost of just financially not ever being around again.
Well, there's always going to be a group of individuals that are savvy in business they see that what's happening now will eventually implode. And if you're on the forefront of the evolution and making that motion to try a new model, whether it will fail or succeed, you never know that. I mean, but that's how business is. That's how startup is. That's how disruption goes. You'll either create an iPhone or you'll create a Zune or something like that. You know, you never know. But, you know, even when you create an iPhone, you'll have, you know, the Ballmers of the world at the time saying it won't last, 6 months, when you have BlackBerry just dominating. But until you create something completely new with the idea of knowing where the future is headed, if you have that foundation of something, you can adjust the foundation and you can build upon a foundation. Versus if you try to scramble the surface part without a foundation, it'll always fall through. So how do we open the door or open up the ground for somebody to lay a foundation and support them and say, you know, we can do this, we'll help you, or maybe we should be doing it?
I think we should. I think those that realize it, you know, it being the unsustainability of healthcare, need to step up and stick their neck out a little bit. You know, I said some pretty bold statements today on my blog. I, you know, advocated a value-based compensation system, you know, for providers, which would effectively cut salaries at the top and, you know, reevaluate and elevate the value of some of the salaries at the bottom, simply based on what the consumers perceive. I think by having these conversations, and particularly by having the conversations with key players, medical directors, hospital CEOs, healthcare administrators, even if 1 out of 100 listen, and have the trust, the faith, and the wherewithal and wisdom to see that, yes, this is a solution to pursue it, no matter how politically or professionally wayward it may be. Those, you know, brave souls will help pave the way, and those like us talking about it need to continue the conversation, no matter you know, what kind of angst we might drive in our own direction.
Let's take a quick shift from that and talk about what we'll need to support that system and that vision and that view. So let's say you and I, Ben, we start an insurance company. Let's, hypothetically speaking, say we bring Urson on as a partner. Let's keep speaking hypothetically and say we call it Oliver.
So, this is all very hypothetical, by the way.
Very, very hypothetical. Let's say we're starting an insurance company named Oliver, hashtag Oliver, and we do the groundwork, right? We're laying the foundation. Us three, we write the policies, we get investors, we focus on the customer, we focus on taking care of people. We're still going to make money. Right, it's still a business. Let's not lose sight of that. Right, we're not completely altruistic, which is not the case. But instead of making, let's say, $2 billion, we'll make $500 million, which I don't know about you guys, I'm okay with. And let's say it's growing, and more people get involved, and we get more growth in the network. How do we support that? And more importantly is, how do we involve the next generation of clinicians in being advocates for their patients and let's say spreading the news about Oliver or any other such startup? What do we have to do, I guess I'm asking, is to make sure that our DPT students or med students or whatever student that's coming through has an acute knowledge of such things?
Well, I think we're doing a good job.
Okay, sorry.
Oh, but you know what, Urson, let's hear from you.
Well, basically, I think I have a unique perspective on this because I did, it's not like I did it for 20 years, but I did work for a peer review company that was tied in with several HMOs. So I've seen the way that HMOs and peer review has worked, at least for PT, OT, and DC, and wellness claims and network building. And I've seen what they tried to do. And they actually did try to incentivize better providers who use less visits. They were supposed to have higher reimbursements. And we collected a lot of outcome data using, you know, NDI, Oswestry, Lefts and Dash, and we knew who was doing better. We knew who was overutilizing, underutilizing, and let me tell you, insurance companies wanted no part of that. Providers wanted it, but for some reason, insurance companies, all the ones we contracted with, they just did. It got shut down rather rapidly. But I think that to involve the providers, it would have to be a quality network. And I think that insurance companies, by and large, they easily see overutilizers, and they know who the good providers are, they know who the bad providers are. Only legally you cannot recommend, like if you had to ask your adjuster or your peer reviewer, who would you go to? And even though they would absolutely know who they would go to, they're not legally allowed to make that recommendation. But I think if you do it through incentivization, through higher reimbursements for those who utilize less visits, I mean, that's already done, I believe, in New Zealand, I think, where even manual therapists get higher reimbursement than just the who are called physiotherapists because their outcomes are better, and it's proven in research, and they underutilize. So I think that is a big thing. But the other thing I really saw is that the people who were most responsible for dealing with, you know, the outrage or the customer outreach or the customer service, they were the lowest paid rung of the company. I mean, these are people who, when we were doing a customer service kind of, not a webinar, but a seminar, the guy who was leading it basically said, how many have been working for the company for less than a year? It was about 50% of the company had been working for this peer review place for less than a year, and a good majority of them were in claims and customer service. And these are the people who deal with irate customers. And from what we could tell, being a reviewer, they would just tell upset people whatever they wanted to hear, erroneous or not. And you know, now that I am cash-based and I'm dealing with claims people, and I can say that most of these people do not, it's not Disney. You know, and that's where I wanted to segue into Ben's thinking, because I think Disney has it right, where whether you're dealing with a bus driver who's dropping you off, picking you up at the hotel and dropping you off at Disney, to just a store clerk, to, I mean, anyone working there, it's like our Wegmans in Western New York, if anyone knows what that is.
I love Wegmans.
Everyone who works there, they're just all on board with a quality customer experience. And I think that, you know, you can't lose sight of that. And I think whether it's an insurance company or a tech company or anything, any kind of mega conglomerate, most of them, like, say, a Comcast or a Time Warner Cable, they do not care about their customers at all. And I think anyone can cause disruption if you just are customer focused. So that's my spiel on it. I mean, just
that's
from
good
the
spiel.
Inside.
I like it. Yeah. But I think it has to be more than customer focused, right? I mean, a company can be customer focused, but an insurance company, how many insurance companies are customer focused and clinician focused, or more specifically, good clinician focused?
Yeah, I would say zero. Right.
Exactly. So how do we involve the professions, the medical professions, to support this, let's say hypothetically, Oliver, while supporting them as well?
Well, I did have one other idea before we let that go. I'm sorry. Another part of our incentive of tiered providers. You know, some companies have tiered providers. Some people get more visits if you're tier zero, and if you get tier one, and you only get 10 visits before you get reviewed or something like that. So we were going to have a higher tier of those who are maybe residency or fellowship trained, and or if you had certain certification, or you can say that you demonstrated amount of good con ed. It wasn't just all online, those kind of things. And again, all these great ideas, they were just totally shut down. But I think that those were good ideas, and that's how you could also involve the clinicians and make sure you're building a better network. Is your tiers, maybe they get less review, they get more visits, or they get higher reimbursement. At least at some point, as long as you're reporting honestly, obviously you can't audit everyone, but typically people who have either fellowship or residency credentials, it would be hard to go through all of that and not be a better clinician.
Well, let's talk about residency a little bit. Since you brought it up, we've had a couple people on Twitter ask about residency. So Mark Siolak asked, residency after graduating or wait for clinical experience, personal preference. And another Twitter question, Michael Lau, student PT, asked, what is the number one thing you would recommend #DPT student to do during her 3 years outside of school, which I think lends into residency as well. So what do you guys think? Residency, no residency? Should we incentivize residency as an insurance company? Let's say we're Oliver and we're looking at all the clinicians coming through, and when they submit to be part of our insurance company, and we ask them, have you had residency and fellowship training? Do we put a lot of weight into that?
I think we should. You know, I think that's the very problem with, fee for service healthcare, is that the quality of outcome doesn't matter, right? So long as you have the least expensive provider doing the job and nobody complains too loudly, everything keeps flying. But when you incentivize quality, you know, that value-based equation, now you have something interesting, because it's not just the case experience that is improved, but the overall health of that individual, and thus the following population will be improved. And you'll have a nice positive feedback loop. The better trained clinicians, the better trained, you know, students that go through extra training, new grads, et cetera, will start have a almost like an exponential growth factor to all the treatment they do, all the health that they promote, and all of the all the students that they in turn mentor. To grow, you know, from one to two, and then two to four, and so on. I think you have to encourage this type of growth, and you have to encourage a transparency of outcomes and give financial favoring in terms of compensation to the clinicians and the programs and the institutions and organizations that give you the better health outcomes.
Right, unless there's an incentivization with reimbursement or direct pay, that there'd be no reason for a provider to be better. I mean, take Rochester, for example. A bunch of the PTs basically, and apparently this is collusion. I don't know how they did it without collusion, but they basically got together and they told the HMOs, hey, look, if our reimbursement is very, very low, it's one of the lowest in the nation, and we are all going to drop out of the network or whatever they said. I don't know what it was exactly, unless you raise your reimbursement. And now they have double the reimbursement that Buffalo has, and they're just an hour down the road. But as far as I know, other than, you know, a couple of the few groups that do very very high level and skilled one-on-one care, it's not like the clinic owners with the double reimbursement all of a sudden said, hey, you know what, now I don't need to see double the volume that I wanted to anymore. Now I'm just going to make twice as much money and I'll give my PTs a slight salary bump. I mean, there's still a ton of places that are mills out there. And just because I got double the reimbursement, it didn't matter. So unless there was really a tiers of reimbursement for quality and how you're demonstrating through your amount of visits and utilization and outcomes measures, there'd be no reason to, you know, for anyone to change, really.
So if we're providing a, let's say, kind of a field manual to clinicians, and, you know, let's say the field manual is mainly of how to be customer centric again, because we're not the typical insurance company, right? We don't want to have you see a million patients. We want you to focus on customer experience, because that's how we focus on customer experience. How long before companies actually buy into that and saying, well, what's your angle? Why are you doing this versus trying to screw us over with small reimbursements? And, you know, how do we instill trust in a community? Because I think to disrupt, you have to instill trust, right? You have to show a model that works, and people actually have to trust you that, one, what you're talking about is feasible, and two, that what you're presenting is based on some kind of knowledge, and that you have that knowledge, right? I think I mentioned this before in the podcast when we were just getting the ARC developed, and we spoke when an investor reached out before our Kickstarter campaign. You know, one of the best pieces of advice that I got was, he said that nobody cares about your product; they care about you, because your product doesn't exist yet. So all the trust is instilled in you as a person and your story and what you represent. So how do we disrupt, and more importantly, how do we instill trust, Ben, into the healthcare community, into our students, so they follow us, so they see that disruption is possible, and we're going to lead the way?
That's a deep question.
You better believe it.
You know, trust has, like you said, a lot to do with who you know, how well you know them, and if they've demonstrated what they said they're going to do consistently. And I think that may be the best place to start. And it may be the only place to start, especially if we're, you know, hypothetically starting up some type of company, regardless of what it is, what product they sell and what service they provide, is you, as the provider of such a product, must state your service brand experience. And you have to keep to it. And you must repeatedly demonstrate that consistently and uphold that value and uphold that expectation. And when you do that, you start to develop that social proof where people start to trust you, because they start seeing that it doesn't matter who you serve, it doesn't matter what you sell, it is always better, always valuable for all the stakeholders involved. From there, I think you have to launch into the numbers. Can we still trust you? You've demonstrated proof of concept. But can we still trust you for the long run? Is this going to be something that is going to last? And I think that's where with something we're talking about, with a value-based, quality-based, almost a triple threat approach to healthcare, clinician and finance and the consumer, all surrounding this element of human quality, that's where it's really going to shine. When you see the long-term impact, saving so much more money and so much more cost and so much more life quality, you know, across the spectrum, that's where that trust begins. You know, at this point, because we're so early in the game of talking, a lot of it has to be repute and goodwill. You know, the more we're willing to lead by example, even though it may cost us, you know, more than we're getting gain from it, it demonstrates that we're willing to grow, develop, and cultivate a community that holds like-minded values, like-minded goals, and a developing culture that wants this whole story, this whole living being, to be better.
Yes, story. You know, that's story and culture. I think it's two important words and kind of buzzwords now, I would say. I think I agree with you. I think culture is incredibly important to establish and establish early. Unfortunately for us, at least in the physical therapy profession, our culture is, I would say, fractured. We're all over the place, right? We are so spread out in our perceptions, our theories, our language, our interpretation of ideas, that we don't have a culture, right? We have a hodgepodge of professionals trying to push each other forward in cliques. We're in high school, right? Physical therapy is in high school right now. We have cliques that are kind of pushing each other forward and trying to keep control of the cafeteria. And that's not how we're going to succeed. We need to unite and move forward. So, and I think that's going to take a lot of work. So, and that's probably going to take a lot more podcasts. So I want to give Dr. E some closing thoughts on this. What do you think?
Well, I mean, Ben has a lot of great ideas. And again, just like any of other amazing business-minded guests, I think we could definitely have him on for repeated podcasts, because we're only scratching the surface. And
could and should and will.
Absolutely, yes, yes. I think that, you know, disruption has to occur at this point, and I think that especially healthcare is a market that is ripe for it. I mean, change needs to occur because, as Ben has said multiple times, it's unsustainable. It's been unsustainable for a while. And I think these companies that start up and disrupt things like Uber, you know, we could be the Uber of healthcare. I think that that's needed. I'm willing to hypothetically do that. I think that culture is important. Getting a following and network is important. And I think that triple threats of finance and clinician focus and customer focus is all very, very important. I mean, I think that's a great starting point. Let's go pitch it on Shark Tank. I don't know if anyone's ever gone on Shark Tank twice, Gene.
I don't know either. Well, if I get on that first time, I'll
let you know. That's right. You only tried out for it, right?
Auditioned. And we're still in the process of hearing if we're going to be on the show for this upcoming season. They told us we'll find out between now and summertime if we'll be on. So fingers crossed. All right, Ben. So we're starting a hypothetical insurance company, hashtag Oliver. By the way, this is hypothetical. If when you're listening to this podcast, you are interested in me and Ben and Urson starting an insurance company, tweet us out at hashtag Oliver with us on there. And we'd love to get your thoughts and talk about it a little bit more. But Ben, to finish out, obviously we can talk about this a lot more. And I, like Urson said, I really hope you join us and we talk more about stuff like this.
Be happy to.
How do we unite ourselves as a profession? I'd like to end that with that thought. I know that was one of your blog posts too, about you mentioned about infighting and
PTs and PTAs, but even more than that, PT within PT, there's so much stuff going on. How do we put up a united front? Because honestly, without a united front, we're not going to get anything accomplished. We're tiny compared to the AMA. We're nowhere near as united as chiropractors are. And, you know, I don't know about you, but I always get asked the question of, well, what do you think about chiropractors? Or what do you think about acupuncturists? I tell people the same thing usually. It's, look, there's good ones, there are bad ones, but when you live in a glass house, you shouldn't be throwing rocks. There's plenty of good and bad PTs and plenty of issues within our own profession to start picking fights with anybody else. So how do we make that better? How do we unite?
Well, I think we need to unite by first remembering our commonalities. You know, the first thing I always hear is, oh, PT is so diverse, you know, even in just an outpatient, it's so diverse, not to mention, you know, inpatient and the various branches and settings in inpatient. And I just try to remind myself, you know, as physical therapists, physiotherapists, you know, we treat, you know, human physiology, you know, as it matters to at least what the English language can translate to is physical health in one way or the other, inside out, and typically through, you know, non-invasive means. I feel that as a profession, we need to reunite at the commonality of it all. What is the commonality behind inpatient, outpatient, home health, SNF, whatever you want, all the various approaches, regardless of if they agree or not with their models? That commonality needs to be identified and promoted at the academic level, at the associative level, at any other paraprofessional organizations, at those levels. I say it a lot. It's like Starbucks. It's like Disney. You know, Starbucks isn't only coffee, but coffee is their image. It's their identity. But they do so much more than that and offer so much more, and their revenue streams demonstrate that. Disney's the same thing. Disney's more than Mickey Mouse in theme parks. Yet they, you know, within that portfolio, they have Marvel and they have Pixar and they have Star Wars. But it all circulates to what Walt Disney said. It all started with the mouse. Yeah. I think we need to come back to that. I blogged probably 2 years ago, is we need to go back to our Mickey Mouse moment. And I think our Mickey Mouse moment can be multidimensional. You know, it doesn't have to be a clinical expertise, because I'm not sure that our consumers care about that.
Let me ask you this, though. Have we had our Mickey Mouse moment yet? We are, in the grand scheme of things, still a fairly new medical profession, right? Certainly. Physical therapy, what, started out in 1940s, something like that, with the women's right movement. Medicine has been around 200 plus years in terms of doctors. So have we really had our Mickey Mouse moment? Are we still evolving to the point where our moment is coming in the future, and we need to get ourselves together to have that new moment of who we really are?
You know, that's a certain possibility. You know, and if we are having that moment, you know, I would suggest that that moment needs to center around how we care, to bring the humanity back to the medical professions and to the business of healthcare, and to make it beyond what they may call a people business, beyond what perhaps people even call social responsibility. I would consider that our Mickey Mouse moment may very well revolve around being a people purpose.
Which we are, right? And that's what is unique about physical therapy compared to a lot of other professions, in medical professions at least, is that we spend a lot more time with patients than anybody else. I'm sure you can say that about nurses, and you can make a case for that for chiropractors. But somebody had ACL tear, you know, you're going to spend months with them. And if even back pain, you might spend weeks, and you spend a lot of time one-on-one, or hopefully one-on-one with your patients. And I don't know about you, but that, to me, that's my favorite part of the job, is talking and getting to know people. And anybody can learn a skill. Anybody can learn a technique. Yes, some can learn better than others and do it better than others. But the skill of communication, interpersonal skill, making connections, using empathy instead of sympathy. I mean, the relationship is our calling card, or should be. And I
mentioned this before again in the podcast, is I like to think of it as an experience. When people come to see me, I don't want them to think, oh crap, I'm going to PT. I want them to think, oh, I'm gonna go see Gene, and we're gonna talk about, oh, hey, I saw this commercial that I can't wait to tell them about, or I saw this baseball game. And I more times than not, I get patients coming in saying, oh, hey, I thought about you and I wanted to tell you this. And that moment, when I have those moments, that's what I remember the most. You know, I expect to help people because that's what I was trained to do, give them strategies, educate them, manipulations, dry needling, whatever, it doesn't matter. You're trained to do that. But to have a person look forward to coming in to see you, to tell you, hey, I saw this and I thought of you, couldn't wait to tell you, I was looking forward to telling you, or, you know, my wife says hi because you treated my wife or talked to her, something like that. You know, just that human piece that I feel lacks from quote-unquote good clinicians or good healthcare providers.
It's about the people.
It's about the people. All right, Ben. So thanks for joining us. We'd love to have you on again. Do you have any final thoughts on this topic or topics?
Well, I think we've covered a wide range of them, but I think it does come back to what we just last spoke of. It's all about, you know, people. I think we need to, as providers, as payers, as consumers, return healthcare back to humanity. And I think the sooner we do that, the sooner we'll find sustainable solutions, agree upon sustainable solutions. You know, for physical therapists, we just might get lucky and find our Mickey Mouse moment.
That's right. You know, the best way to get lucky is, or the saying is, the harder you work, the luckier you'll get. So that's what we'll continue to do. And so after you listen to this podcast, remember, tweet it out to us with hashtag Oliver. If you want Ben and I to start an insurance company, and we'll throw Urson in there, and maybe even Jerry Durham. So shout out at Jerry Durham. Can you imagine that? Four of us running an insurance company, Ben?
I can. And I think people will be very, very happy with their pocketbook and with their lives.
There you go. I mean, that's a slogan right there. Happy with your pocketbook, happy with your lives. Hal Oliver. All right. So thanks again. Thanks for listening. We will do our best to get Ben on as soon as possible and talk more topics. Thanks to everyone that contributed on Twitter. We had some awesome questions that I think we've covered all of them. And if we missed you on Twitter, it's because we finished before you tweeted it out. So we'll answer you on Twitter. If you haven't subscribed yet, please subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Just search Therapy Insiders. If you're driving now or doing something where you can't subscribe now, put it in your head and remember it. And whenever you get somewhere, subscribe. Don't do it while you're driving. That's not safe. But if you're in a place that you can subscribe, please do it. We're also on Stitcher now. And you can always find us at therapyinsiders.com. It's been great getting all the feedback, all the emails that I get. It's really awesome. So, you know, we've been doing this just because it's been a lot of fun and getting people on and having these kinds of conversations that we've had with Ben. So we look forward to getting more and more and growing, and we look forward to getting your input. So let us know what you think. Leave us some feedback on iTunes. You know, reviews are super helpful. They keep us climbing in the charts so more people can hear the podcast, and that helps us out a lot. So thanks for listening, and we'll catch you again next time.